This is Cindy Gomez Shemp. You're listening to A Mexican Crossing Lines on 88.1 FM, KPPP LP Fargo Moorhead, where we are adding local color to your airwaves. Mm-hmm. We're also broadcasting online. You can find us on Shoutcast by going to kpppfm.com. Could you please state your name?
Stephen Lewis Simpson.
Yes, and you are the filmmaker for the movie Neither Wolf Nor Dog?
That's correct.
I was really excited. I actually had some of our listeners and viewers on social media send me your information about the movie, telling me that this would be perfect for our station. I must contact you immediately. And then I got your email as well. And so I was like, wow, how exciting. An opportunity to talk to the filmmaker.
It's been great. The social media crowd has really gotten behind the film, and it's been a big part of the success in terms of the passion of the people waiting to see it.
Well, there's something about this. You know, first of all, I wanted to have our listeners hear about the basis of the story. It's from a novel. Could you talk a little bit about where the film comes from?
Yeah, I mean, the novel came out in the mid-90s, was a Minnesota Book Award-winning novel. And, I mean, essentially the story follows a white author who gets sucked into a road trip through the heart of Lakota country with a Lakota elder and his sidekick, and it's contemporary, and it's very much about, you know, forcing him to open his eyes to, you know, this elder's perspective worldview and the world that he lives in. And it sort of reflected some of the elders that the author Kent Nerburn himself had experienced over the years.
Mm-hmm. And it's shot, it's filmed in South Dakota primarily.
Yes, the road movie sort of starts from, in the story starts in Bemidji, and then sort of works its way through north into South Dakota and ends up at goes through the Badlands into Wounded Knee. But, you know, in a film, especially when you've got a very low budget, you have to, you know, roll your locations together. And so we filmed, you know, mostly in the southwest part of South Dakota. I'd filmed two features before on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and knew the area well. And there was a lot of great landscapes that could double for other things, but nowhere else could double for the Badlands or for Wounded Knee. So we shot mostly around there. A little bit even in Nebraska, because there's a beautiful museum down there that I really wanted to use, and, you know.
And this is kind of interesting, but you're not from America.
No, I'm a Scotsman.
And what is it about the Dakotas, what is it about this area that has brought you back time and time again to film?
Well, it was the summer of 99 that I first came out, and I mean, it was one of those things. I mean, I've been developing a project that related to the Paiute prophet Wovoka, the ghost dance religion, and the events that led up to Wounded Knee. And there just so happened to be a ghost shirt from the massacre that had been sitting in a museum in Scotland ever since. And it was decided to repatriate it, and I came out on that trip. And so many incredible things happened in such a short space of time that I sort of found myself in the midst of things with some amazing people and being asked to film. And, you know, that became the part of a feature documentary I made about the reservation that I made over about a 13-year span. And I also shot a love story thriller movie called Res Bomb there a number of years ago as well. But the bulk of it now is friendship. I mean, I have so many dear friends there, and I just, you know, I have the best time when I'm around, but also from a practical standpoint, I find it very easy to film in the area. The locations are just glorious, but, you know, it's wonderful. People are so welcoming, and, you know, you don't deal with any of the hassles that you do filming in big cities. It's quite lovely.
And would you say that this undertaking for you in some ways mirrors, you know, making this novel into a movie, in some way mirrors the white protagonist's role in this movie as well?
Well, in, In a sense, it does, but in a way, what mirrors it more, perhaps, is the feature documentary that I've made, because, you know, that was local people, you know, who I became friends with, you know, who knew I was a filmmaker, and, but more important to that was the fact that I kept coming back, and they were so used to people coming out there for 5 minutes and, you know, professing loyalty and then never being heard from again, mm-hmm. and, so, you know, that was, you know, my first key commitment, if you like. And then, you know, I made a pledge 6 years ago to the author that by any means necessary, I would, you know, bring the film to the big screen. I mean, it's just sort of the way that I operate. It's sort of, you know, if you're going to take on a film project, you've got to, you know, see it the whole way through. Most never even start the first day's filming because it's so hard to pull them together. But here we are.
It is definitely a labor of love, and it has been received immensely well.
Yeah. It's one of those incredible things that, you know, the distribution of it couldn't have happened even just 5 years ago, because one of the things is technology's helped greatly with digital cinemas, but social media has been such a huge key part of it, the way that we're getting the word out, mm-hmm. and also the way that, that people are taking ownership of the film in the most amazing way. You know, there's a lot of people who feel like they're a key part of, you know, getting the word out, and they are. I mean, we're having, you know, so many people giving me direct feedback after screenings and posting numbers of how many people were there and sharing reviews online. And it helped sustain me through this time because, you know, through this process, I mean, I'm the one, you know, doing all of the jobs with distribution as it was with the film. And, you know, it's a lonely process, and that, you know, this fan base out there have been so supportive. It's made the world a difference. We wouldn't be where we are if it wasn't for them. I mean, we were the number one film in Bemidji when it was released there, beating 9 Hollywood films in a multiplex. You know, 1,600 people came out in a town of 15,000 because people were driving from far and wide around coming in because the word of mouth was so strong. And, you know, we just had 22 days in the theater in Bismarck. And, again, similar thing. It's really amazing.
And the film, it's sort of like a documentary feel to it. Was that intentional?
Well, it's really interesting because stylistically it doesn't, in the sense that it's a very... You know, and one thing that people talk a lot about is the cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you know, I'm utilizing the Great Plains. I'm placing the people within the nature, within the frame. So it's very eye-catching. It's very pretty to look at,
mm-hmm.
as that region is. So it's not shot like a documentary in that sense. What's making people associate it to a documentary is the fact that the characters are just so believable.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting so lost in the film that way. But also a key thing that I did in it towards the end was, you know, the film, as the novel does, ends up at Wounded Knee. And I abandoned the novel and the script at that point, and I let Dave Bald Eagle, who played the Elder, take complete ownership of that scene. And it's this, in a sense, this improvisation between the two leads. And it doesn't feel improvised in a stylistic sense, because it's just 100% real. It's more real than anything that I or Kent Nerburn could have ever written. And it's the presence of, I mean, my entire cast, I was very, very fortunate, but because they're all wonderful, but Dave Bald Eagle just is unlike anyone else we've ever seen on screen before. He, as he was in life, he had an extraordinary life, and that is all etched on his face and in his smile, which just twinkles through his eyes like nobody you've ever seen. It was just, he was just a great gift to, you know, through the film, I think, to the audience.
What do you think about this particular film, the story that is being told, the topics that are being touched upon, that are so poignant to the viewers?
Well, you know, for one of the, I mean, one of the key aspects is the, you know, the sort of cross-cultural dialogue, which, you know, for me is quite interesting because it's not all about just, you know, a white guy and a Lakota guy. It's very much a white American perspective. And as a European going into Lakota country, it's a very, very different experience. I mean, we all just turn up with big goofy smiles on our faces without the same sort of mental baggage or spiritual baggage or whatever it might be, and just make friends. I mean, I travel extensively in the last 18 months, 21 countries I've been in, and there's nowhere I go that I feel I'm embraced more than Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, which is interesting because, you know, other people that I talk to in the region here see Pine Ridge as a terrible, scary place. And for me, it's the most hospitable place I've just about ever been. And I know deeply a lot of the issues that are going on there, but, you know, very often I think people see it only from one side. And what Dan, the character, does in this film with Dave Bald Eagle, he, you know, in part transforms the perception, and Richard Ray Whitman, who plays Grover, they are such deep characters, such full characters, that, you know, the audience associates with them in a different way. Their hearts are deeply opened by them. Because, you know, it's one of these things that people fall into stereotype constantly when it comes to Indian country in a way that's so unique. In a way, it's either, you know, a very kind of, you know, hard-edged, simplistic, you know, racist view, or some fanciful, romantic view, and all those other things in between. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have friends from all walks of life on Pine Ridge. I mean, you know, I have a friend who's traveling the U.S., based in California, but from Pine Ridge, who's doing huge business deals into the hundreds of millions and occasionally into billions of dollars through some of his partners, hugely successful. Another friend who's an executive that runs all the HR House of Blues around the United States, who's from Pine Ridge. You know, the only Olympic gold medalist I know is from Pine Ridge, Billy Mills. You know, so I know a lot of people there who are at the absolute pinnacle of people that I know in my life. And then I know, you know, I've had other friends who've killed themselves and everything else in between. And, you know, I think one of the key things, you know, about this film is that, you know, for once, even though I'm a filmmaker from the outside, it's you know, not that I've, you know, not spent a lot of time and got to know a lot of people there to see so many things in individual characters, but also could look at the Kent Nerburn character as an outsider as well, because in a sense, a lot of his attitudes are more alien to me, you know, because there's this ocean between us. And so being able to see that dance was very important.
Do you think that your perspective as an outsider, as a non-American, has been beneficial in the creation of this film?
Very much. And I, to be honest, I think that there's a great history of that in cinema. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of, you know, the great movies of one culture or another have been, you know, through the lens of, you know, a fascinated outsider who could see the dance at play. I mean, I think there's sort of, you know, it's like when I'm back in Scotland and I'm listening to friends who are, you know, who were, you know, immigrants into Scotland, and they talk about, you know, their experience amongst the Scottish people, I learn so much that I never knew about my people. And, you know, I think that there's a danger if you're always, you know, and this is the thing, I think if a white American had directed this, I think there would be a huge part of the dynamic that would have been missing. Mm. But the most important part of it is that it's so not to fall into stereotype with any character. And so for me, it's every character is just incredibly distinct. And that's the worst part of Hollywood typically doing films in Indian country, is that they just fall on stereotypes in a way that they typically don't with most other groups. Mm-hmm. And I can never quite comprehend that, because, you know, and there's this other thing that takes place. Sometimes there's, you know, very real textured films shot in Indian country with real people, and people in the world jump up and down and embrace it as this really real thing. But very often, because they're filming with amateurs, it lacks a lot of the humor and the charisma and whatever else that those real individuals have in their own lives because they're self-conscious on screen. And the rest of the world doesn't, you know, they don't have the on-the-ground experience to understand that they're seeing very muted performances. I mean, that's one of the other dynamics I think is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, the performers in the film, you know, are very proud of it. I mean, Dave, before he passed, saw it and absolutely loved it, as does his family, and Richard Ray Whitman was incredibly proud of it, and everyone else who's involved, because they all knew that we were doing something very real between the characters. You know, none of the characters say anything that they wouldn't have said. I mean, I gave complete ownership, authorship to that with all my actors, in the sense that, you know, if they feel there's a, if they felt there's a false line, we'd work on it.
And Dave said something about this movie, that it was the only movie that told the truth.
He said it was the only movie he'd been in about his people that told the truth. Because he'd been in and out of movies, mostly in smaller roles over the years. And I think it was very much the fact that it wasn't, you know, wasn't playing into any sort of one-dimensional, you know, fantasy or, I mean, I think it's also that thing for him, it was that very primal thing relating to Wounded Knee, which, you know, there was nothing more important to him than to, you know, to share that story with the world.
And it's not something that, as Americans, we have taken the time to look at in our history, especially when dealing with indigenous peoples. And so a lot of times people shy away from these types of topics, that kind of self-examination. It doesn't necessarily make it into a lot of films. Do you think that's what he was referring to, alone, or do you think there was something more that he was referring to when he said that this is the only film that he participated in that told the truth about his people?
I think it's probably a combination of the both. I mean, you know, it's interesting when I look at archive footage from maybe, you know, 1920 of some festival in a border town in, say, western South Dakota, where a lot of brutal things had happened not long before. I mean, where there were people still around who would have survived Wounded Knee, for example. And there's an interaction going between those communities, between the Lakota and the white community, that would have been very hard to imagine in the 60s, for example. And I keep wondering about that. And one of the key things that's changed to me is that that's when, you know, Hollywood in its heyday, once you start hitting the 30s, the 40s, particularly the 50s, and you have the constant outpouring of the one-dimensional, you know, savage myth, and, you know, and kids growing up around that, the vision that might not have even been there earlier than that. And also, in some respects, the separation. I mean, there's always been, you know, incredible prejudice, but I think it was also a point where, you know, everyone was going through hardship at a certain point. I mean, the other day I watched the Casey Tibbs documentary, which was a very good piece, and looking at his childhood, and he was friends with Dave Ballwiebel, and appreciating the fact that, you know, they grew up in a very similar situation day to day. I mean, it was just purely the hardship of the land. And how much more relatable that would have been than, say, to the two communities in the 60s, where one's now living in an air-conditioned house and then the other's still living, you know, under very difficult circumstances on the reservation. I mean, I still have friends today who have, you know, outhouses and no running water and all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so that division has gotten bigger, whereas if you're in the 1920s, no one had running water and everyone had outhouses. It didn't matter which side of the fence you're on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think, but, you know, I think, you know, I think authorship had a big part of it, what Dave was saying, because, you know, he knew that, you know, I sometimes I get questioning comments from some natives who haven't seen the film yet going, but hold on a second, it's just a white guy telling a story authored by a white guy. And then when the people see it, I get a very different response, because part of the difference is that, you know, every word on the page written by somebody is written by that person. But the thing with this film is that everything that comes out of Dave's mouth, he has ownership of. You know, some of it was on the page, some of it we worked on from that, but some of it was 100% his, and the most important words were 100% his. And I think that's a key part of it for him.
Well, the other interesting, I guess, sidebar to this is that the adversity that you spoke of, you know, your cast have had remarkable lives of their own.
Yes. Very much.
They've been, you know, they've been through incredible hardship and difficulty in their lives that have shaped the character not only of these people, but also the stars in your movie.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, there was a lot of weight in terms of what we were doing, the investment that we all had emotionally. It was very deep. And, for example, you know, Dave Bald Eagle was left for dead on D-Day. He was in the 82nd Airborne, parachuted into the wrong part of a garrison town, and most of them were dead before they hit the ground. And, you know, Christopher Sweeney, who played Nurburn, had the Silver Star from the Gulf War. And Richard Ray Whitman, the third lead, was never in the service and yet spent more days under fire than these two noted veterans. And it was at Wounded Knee, South Dakota in 73, when he was there for the majority of the 71-day occupation, where, I mean, I remember seeing an NPR, a PBS documentary about that incident where they estimated up to 500,000 bullets being fired in over those 71 days, which is, you know, quite almost impossible to get your head around. And, you know, so Richard experienced that. I mean, Richard was from Oklahoma, but in part because of that and his time since, Pine Ridge has always been sort of a second home to him. And even then, I mean, Tatanka Means was one of the supporting cast, and his father, Russell, was a dear friend of mine, and with Dennis Banks and some others were the instigators of that occupation in 73. And David had, you know, relatives that were caught up in the massacre. And so when we were filming there, it was fascinating because the first day we filmed there was the third day, and Dave had been, you know, taking time to settle in because at 95, it's hard to remember lines and things like that. And he did a ceremony and a prayer before we started filming. And then the rest of the day, he just started nailing every scene he did. And it was similar a couple of other times when we were filming parts of the Wounded Knee sequence. Mm-hmm. He drew a strength that didn't exist at any other point. And it was just extraordinary. It was just, you had to be there to understand it. But even then, after filming was over, and I was chatting to his wife, Josie, about the film, and she was saying, you know, not long before filming, he was barely able to walk. And yet in the film, there's scenes where he's, you know, walking for a couple of minutes through Wounded Knee or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she said, you know, the moment we started filming, he just drew strength that wasn't there before and after. It was just remarkable. I mean, at 95 years old, to take on by far the biggest role he ever had done and do it fearlessly. I mean, it was just, but that was the man. Mm-hmm. He was a gift to us all just knowing him.
And it's kind of different than having a big, you know, budget film with, you know, dozens of stars, and having a film like this where you have a smaller cast, a smaller budget, but a much greater purpose. And
yeah.
And that the work and the commitment behind each of these actors and the way that the film came together, it really, I think, is a legacy that you're leaving, not only for Dave Bald Eagle and for the the other actors that are participating in this film. But within
yes.
the genre of telling stories about Indigenous people of this region. Because I don't think, you know, it's hard to describe this film when people have asked me about it. To just say, you know, it's like, it's one of those journey films, or it's one of those, I don't know. It's how would you describe it? Because it's very complex. It's not it's not just a hop in the car, Thelma and Louise style film.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny in a way that it almost has a similarity to a popcorn movie in the sense that it's an experience. It's something that you have to, you know, in a popcorn movie, they want to kind of buckle you in for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And in a strange way with this, we're having you almost settle in. It's like, you know, the film is paced in a way that you have to pay attention the way that the author is taught by the elder to pay attention. And it doesn't spoon feed you. And it's interesting because people have been coming back to see it time and time again because there's a feeling that they draw from it that they want to re-experience, as well as, you know, picking up some of the details along the way. And it's fascinating. I mean, it's you know, there's a sort of age-old saying in film that you don't know what you have until you put it in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very true. I mean, one of the things that surprises me, I mean, I hope a lot of your listeners can see it with a large audience because, you know, when you preview a film, you just show it to individuals. And it wasn't until I had a large audience of a few hundred people watching it, I appreciated how much laughter and how much there is from people watching the film. It was extraordinary. I didn't realize there were that many funny lines. And it's beautiful because, and even, for example, I had some very popular screenings at festivals in Germany, and the audience was laughing there at least as much as anywhere else, even though there was no way they could have gotten some of the jokes because they were very much Lakota humor. And that was even better because it meant that they were so connected with the characters that it was the joking that they were laughing at, not the joke, not the punchline. And that was so beautiful because that's where, you know, I mean, the funny thing about humor is, you know, they always say humor is regional. But it's sort of that thing that when you tap into the wavelength of a humor means that you're starting to really appreciate the culture that you're in. And, you know, it's why when you travel the world, you appreciate that around the world. Is that, you know, we all, you know, I'm British, we love puns and irony and all these other things. And it takes the time to tune into those things. So all these things are beautiful. To share that with an audience and have them connect with it so deeply.
Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't slouch on the reviews either. I mean, it looks like you got a 9.2 out of 10 on IMDb and
yeah.
a 4.9 out of 5 on Rotten Tomatoes, and that's nothing to sneeze at. I mean, in the industry, that's incredible, yeah. actually.
Well, it is, and the best part about it is that, you know, that is what the audience is feeling about the film. It's not some, you know, pretentious New York Times critic. It's people that are experiencing something. They're being touched. And the beautiful part about it is that, you know, a lot of the people that first saw it and were first reviewing it were people that loved the novel. And as we well know, most people are disappointed with the movie adaptations and novels because, you know, movies are extremely complex to make. They have so many moving pieces. And for you to match any kind of story is very hard. I mean, if you're doing the Da Vinci Code, you know, your lead character has to look like Tom Hanks or Tom Cruise or two or three other people to have enough money to make that film. And typically these things don't. And where I was incredibly lucky is that Dave was more than I think anyone imagined Dan to be on the page because he has just this one-off magic. And I looked around extensively before I found him, and no one else came close. I mean, if trying to describe it on screen, screen. I mean, you know, for example, in the movie Thunderheart, there was an elder Ted Thinnell who had a few scenes, and he just stole the show. He was so much more interesting than anyone else. And then in you had Chief Dan George, very famously in Little Big Man, and then the outlaw Josie Wales, who is one of the more memorable people that we've ever seen on screen. Mm-hmm. And it's like imagining, you know, those sorts of presences on screen, but given an entire movie to glow in, and then plus even like another 10 or 15 years of life, because, you know, Dave was 95 at that point, and, you know, every year he was racking up, there was, you know, almost like even a bigger light about him. It was incredible.
That's amazing that you had the opportunity to do that. And, you know, I have to say, I think this film is so timely, especially in the Dakotas. I can't discuss the timeliness of this film without mentioning Standing Rock that just took place here and how that captured the world. Everyone had their eyes on North Dakota and what was happening at the Standing Rock Reservation. So,
yes.
I think there are many issues that this movie raises that would be very timely and also very fitting for what is happening to us right now in North Dakota. Would you like to discuss what your thoughts on that is?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting to me because, you know, obviously, you know, the film had been shot and everything before that came on the scene, and it's brought up quite a lot. And my take on it is I see there's a great value for the film relating to it, but in a slightly different way, because a lot of the people from outside Indian countries that had been, you know, jumping onto that movement and getting involved in those issues, you know, to them, Indian country still is, even then, a simplistic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Ray Whitman really summed it up. He was talking about this elder, I can't remember her name at this point, who was one of the last people arrested at Standing Rock. And, you know, there was a famous photograph of her at Wounded Knee in 73, and Richard was friends with her back then. And this lady had been for, you know, 44 years, you know, in the same sort of protests. And the fact that it's a multi-generational thing. And, you know, the outside world, you know, in terms of talking about water protectors and the issue, it's, you know, for me, I see it as an opportunity of taking those individuals who are getting involved and actually trying to have, you know, Dave and Richard and the rest of the cast take them much deeper into that world to expand their understanding, I as well as all the other people who are less involved, less connected, because it really does open people's hearts. And, you know, there was an Ojibwe elder lady who posted something very beautiful after seeing it in Bemidji. She talked about how satisfying it felt to her walking out of the theater after the lights had already come up, because everyone sat through the credits. And she looked back and she said all the white people in the audience were still rooted to their seats. And she talked about how wonderful it was for her to have that feeling that at least for these few minutes that Dave Baldy had opened their hearts and their minds in a way that perhaps they had not before. And when I read that, I just was so excited because, and Dave would have been very proud of that.
Yeah. I think that that's one of the things that stuck out to me about the film. And I mean, not just Dave as a Lakota man sharing a message that opened up people's minds and hearts, but as an elder. Because, you know, there's a point in the film at which the woman says, you came all this way. You're not even respecting him. You're not showing him any respect. And the white man doesn't quite understand what she's talking about. Doesn't feel like he feels like he's doing everything to show him respect.
Yeah.
There's this something that's unspoken about what we think we need to do to show people in Indian country respect, or what we need to do to show them allyship. And this film really, really gets into that conversation in a very visceral way about how do you form partnerships of respect.
And I think the interesting thing about that scene, for example, is, you know, they're actually both right. I mean, because that's the thing that's within a lot of this with a little life, it's not black and white. I mean, it's, you know, this guy has traveled a long way and, you know, in good faith. And, you know, what he says is true. It's just quite petty next to the gravity of what, you know, Dan is looking to share. I mean, it doesn't diminish it. It's real to him, but he sort of is schooled in a sense on how petty he's actually being, or how small he's being, relative term, and that is part of what makes that scene so fun. You know, you gotta beef up the characters sometimes just to help show those things more clearly, you know.
Yeah, and there was really this sense of struggle, you know, in when they were talking about how when a white man rises up, it's called a revolution. When Native people rise up, it's called a revolt, etc., etc.
Yeah.
And this was something that you could see that he was struggling with. And also, how does he respect the voice of this elder in telling his story, right? Because this elder chose him.
But I think in a sense when he's reading that, he's going, because there's a level of intrigue. He's never thought of it this way before. And you know, I think he's absorbing it. He's not dismissing it as such, because it's part of what's opening the level of intrigue.
Of course.
But I think what's at the core of it, I read this review this Native guy had written this morning, because he saw it last night in Sacramento, and he was talking about, you know, he talked about how great Christopher Sweeney is in that role, and, you know, saying it never, you know, he's always real, it's never sort of Kevin Costner, if you like, and you know, he allows his emotions to be buffeted around that way, and you know, I think it's also that thing about there's listening and then there's listening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in some respects, one of the things I learned from Kent Nerburn while traveling with him through Indian country was that often when he's with elders, if anything, he's trying to be too respectful. So to me, anyone who has wisdom in life has a great sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see it in the Bishop Desmond Tutus of the world, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Always looking for the punchline.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm with elders, I'm typically we're firing jokes back and forth and having a wonderful time. And that's part of the difference, is Kent in that space is trying to be very respectful, whereas for me it's all about giving of yourself as fully as possible. And for me that is, you know, having as much fun as possible, or being as engaged as possible, or having as deep a dialogue as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And too often being overly respectful, you're just diminishing yourself. You don't want to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing or whatever.
Yes,
and that was part of the fun of it. That was why my perspective as a foreigner, so to speak, I could see that. I was just hanging out with a couple of friends from Pine Ridge earlier, and you know, the entire time we're just cracking jokes and cracking jokes and cracking jokes. humor is everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's almost like the character is learning in front of you, and the audience is also learning as the character is learning to listen, to learn, right? And to let go.
Yes, the challenge of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many asks of this movie. I'm glad that you took the time to walk through it with me, with our audience, because I think it's definitely one of those movies that we've got right here in Fargo. You don't have to travel 6 hours to see it, although some people have and have happily done so. So since we have that opportunity, it's going to be here at the theater starting tonight.
West Acres.
At the West Acres.
Seven screenings a day today it was. Amazing. And it's also, for those people that might be listening online or whatever, up the road in... it's in East Grand Forks as well from today at the River Cinema there. It's wonderful because we've in the vast majority of theaters that it's been in, it's been in or around Indian country and drawing strong Native and non-Native audiences. And that's sort of perfect because, you know, the dialogue is almost extending from the theater and, it's, you know, sometimes when you make a film, some films, when they're too art house, it becomes something that just preaches to, you know, the chattering classes, the intellectuals, and whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is, you know, the danger. It becomes a failure at that point for me because it's not reaching, you know, the people that it's most likely to touch. In their hearts and in their spirits, and I think that some people, especially with a lot of youth that are being taken to it, I think it changes their perspectives. I think some, you know, non-natives will see it and they will, you know, have the first time perhaps on screen they've seen a native character that they fall madly in love with because, you know, Dave just does that. And for a lot of young native kids, it's also inspiring, I think, seeing these amazing characters on screen because they're worlds are so rarely reflected back to them, and particularly being able to go to a multiplex and do it rather than, just in a sort of cultural context.
Yes, a lot of films like this, we are grateful if we can watch them at the Fargo Theater, which doesn't have as many seats, but we have the rare opportunity of having it at the Marcus West Acres Theater in Fargo, and... it's also playing in East Grand Forks, so for those of you out there that are out in that region, you don't have any excuses. There's two places right here in North Dakota where you can go and watch this movie. And it's also a great opportunity to take a road trip, right? I mean, this is what it's about.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the reality is that, you know, it's so unusual that, you know, it's popping up in so many places, and it's, you know, it has to be embraced. I mean, you know, it's word of mouth that's propelling us forward, and the only reason that more films like this will come about is because, you know, we're proving to the theaters that there's an audience there. I mean, the film industry didn't pay attention to this film other than the theaters, and we're getting this incredible response from the audience. I mean, you know, there's no other film that Hollywood's providing in that theater tonight that the audience have scored as high as our, you know, very modestly budgeted film, because, you know, you can't buy heart, you know, you just, it doesn't matter what your budget is, you can only create what we have on screen if you have it within the people making it.
Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what this film, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, seeks to bring. We're going to have it right here in Fargo, East Grand Forks 2, at the Marcus West Theater. And what's the theater in East Grand Forks?
The River Cinema 15.
River Cinema 15. So get it, get a group of people to do a viewing party. Invite me, because I want to go back out. And let's watch it together. Let's take the opportunity to have a conversation about this film, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to talk to you about this magnificent film. You've been listening to Stephen Lewis Simpson, the director, the filmmaker of Neither Wolf Nor Dog. Thank you for being with us.
My great pleasure.